Welcome to All Sides with Anna Staver. Donald Trump's promise to make America great again has won him another 4 years in the White House. The former president mounted a political comeback for the history books, winning re-election despite two assassination attempts, a criminal conviction, accusations of attempting to overturn the last election, and a late change in his Democratic opponent. It's a stunning return to power in a cycle that has been known for unpredictability and unprecedented events. Joining me now to talk about it is David Pepper, former Ohio Democratic Party chair. Welcome back to All Sides. Oh.
Thank you, Anna. Good to be with you.
And local attorney and former Democratic Senate candidate Morgan Harper. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
David, Donald Trump didn't run a more moderate campaign. One could argue he ran a campaign that was more polarizing than his previous, and he won. I wonder, what does that say to you about the American electorate?
I mean, I think obviously it's only a few hours later, so it's hard to process or draw too many conclusions. I think he did accomplish being a change candidate, and clearly at a time where people, for I'm sure a variety of reasons, are still looking for change versus a status quo they're not happy with. I think in the end, he benefited from that. I do also think, and this is something that I don't say lightly, you know, there's a broader historic arc around democracy in America. There's sort of what I would consider progress as democracy gets more diverse. And there's also, going back centuries, a pattern of backlash when it does get more diverse. And I think it's very clear that we're living within that arc here, that...
You know, I'm always a little hesitant to Monday morning quarterback because you can't hop in a time machine, go back, see how things would have turned out differently. But, Morgan, the administration, Joe Biden, and the Biden-Harris administration was unpopular. Inflation had come down, but it was prices were still high. Groceries, gas, housing all cost more than they did 4 years ago. I wonder, was it a mistake for Democrats and perhaps for President Joe Biden to insist that he was going to run for a second term, given sort of the economic fundamentals a year ago?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's certainly a topic that's coming up in these after hours
of
processing all the
think pieces.
Yes, yes, yes. And, you know, whether there should have been a more fulsome primary and more time and all of that. Look, I mean, I think the reality is, and we've seen it play out in Ohio races, too, that regardless of who was running, they were going to be linked to the Biden-Harris administration in ads and in different political messaging. And so it would be necessary to find a way to work through that. And, you know, in my view, there have been a lot of good things happening in the Biden-Harris administration to point to. Banning non-compete agreements, making it easier for workers to leave a job and make more money, start businesses, for example. But to David's point, I do think that the economy continues to suffer for a lot of people. Not everyone is invested in the stock market that continues to grow. And we have to have messages that are going to also speak to that desire for change, to see more concrete improvements in people's lives. And I don't think that's just an issue of this election. I think that's been a fight that's been brewing in the Democratic Party for some time. And my hope is that coming out of this, we're going to be able to have real conversations about the type of economic agenda and how that fits into our political messaging moving forward that's going to make us more palatable to a broader set of the population.
David, when you look at some of the results in the swing states, you see a split ticket. Democrats running ahead of Harris. So North Carolina elected a Democratic governor, voted for Donald Trump. Now, that's a bit of a special case because the Republican candidate in North Carolina had a lot of problems, to say, put it mildly. But Michigan, Arizona, Wisconsin, all of these haven't been called yet, but the Democrat is leading in all of these Senate races. Does that say to you that voters were maybe rejecting the current administration, but they, while supporting Democratic policies?
I mean, partly. I mean, obviously, when you're trying to break one of the last glass ceilings, I think it's understating how difficult it is for a woman to win with some of the electorate. Maybe doesn't capture it in polling, but when you see some of that differential, I think that's a factor. I do think in the end, Kamala Harris only had a few months to introduce herself to America, like not a lot of time. I think a lot of the candidates that are doing better than her in a lot of these states have been on the scene for years, you know, in different, you know, Tammy Baldwin or you mentioned North Carolina case or others. So she, you know, when you think about it, when you think about long term, she had very little time to introduce herself. She wasn't that well known as vice president. That may explain part of it. And I do think that as I don't know when I lost the signal earlier, I do think that she and Biden together, and she couldn't really get out of this box. They were sort of the status quo versus the dramatic change that Donald Trump presents. I think in some states that might not have been as sort of clear as again, when Biden stepped away, I mean, he was collapsing. He was the status quo when he dropped out was very negative. And I think maybe that more than a Senate race with someone who's had time to work their state, her candidacy clearly represented, the status quo in a way that maybe made it harder for her. But the thing I was trying to say earlier was I do think there's a broader back and forth going on in our history where we have, you know, years and decades of advancement on democracy and a democracy that represents our full diversity. And then there's backlash. And I think it's if you see that pattern as clearly as it is, and often we don't understand that pattern of history. I mean, you can't remove what we're seeing this back and forth from that long historic pattern either. It's clearly also part of what's in the mix here.
You know, in 2016, there was a question about what kind of president Donald Trump would be. I don't think there's that same question this time around. Trump has been pretty explicit about the kind of president he would be, and he may go on to win the popular vote for the first time in his three elections. Morgan, what's your takeaway from that?
You know, I actually do think there's still a bit of uncertainty about what kind of president he's going to be because his campaign messaging was not very disciplined. He, unlike 2016, he was not sticking to messages critiquing trade agreements. He was not calling out the harms from NAFTA. He was not saying that he was going to take on these corporate giants. He was, as we all saw, all over the place, right? And so, you know, that's going to be one thing that I think we're going to all look at and have to, you know, see how he continues to govern once he's inaugurated. Who is going to be joining his administration? What are their policy backgrounds? What are their corporate affiliations? But look, I mean, I do think that we have to also keep in mind here. I mean, I agree with David that there's, you know, the arc of history does tend to ebb and flow, and there's pushback when there's been seen as periods of progress. But I think one of the consensus positions coming out of this election has to be that there are a lot of people in this country, and especially in Ohio, who do not think the past 40 years have been beneficial to them economically, and especially right. The last 20. And if we're not able to be honest about that, we will continue to lose. And so, you know, I think that's something that has to be part of this reflection that we're making. I'll say, you know, talking to a lot of people and knocking doors throughout this cycle, I was hearing that. Voters very much knew that Donald Trump was not a very stable person. They were discounting a lot of that because they did think that he was going to be more aggressive about that change. And, you know, if I have to, I agree with you, you know, it's always easier to be the Monday morning quarterback. But if I would offer one, you know, critique of the campaign, it did seem like Vice President Harris waffled a bit on how committed she wanted to be to expressing that new economic vision, some of which was put in place during the Biden-Harris administration. Take, for example, you know, talking about some of the litigations that this administration has brought against Kroger Albertsons. And that is an example of what they're doing to try to lower grocery prices to prevent further consolidation in that market. And, you know, and then also when asked how she would distinguish herself from President Biden. I mean, I think a very clear example could have been the frustration that a lot of folks in the public and the business community were feeling around interest rates and perhaps right. considering a change in the leadership of the Fed. These are the types of messages that I think a lot of people were frustrated that we weren't hearing more from. And again, needs to be something that we're considering in our ongoing strategy and messaging as a party.
Yeah.
David, it looks like Trump will be returning potentially with a Republican Congress. The Republicans have taken control of the U.S. Senate. The House is still out, but it could go his way. I hate to keep using words like historic or unprecedented, but Do you think we could see a fundamental remaking of the federal government in the next couple of years?
Yeah, I mean, that's in this House. The House result is enormous as to what will happen. But, you know, I spent the last 6 months hoping it would be somewhat of a hypothetical, and now it's a reality, really studying Project 2025 and everything Trump says in his speeches. And to go back to your prior question, this question, once Project 2025 got unpopular, he sort of ran away from it. But the question before all of us is, okay, what aspects of every part of Trump's stump speech and everything that they wrote down in Project 2025, which normally most of those things happen, they do a plan like this every time, which will happen, which will they get cold feet about? And I think the House makeup will determine that. But if they're very serious about, and I worry everything they wrote down, they call Project 2025 a mandate for leadership. It was all out there. Trump can legitimately say right now that the voters knew all this and voted for me, so I'm going to do it. One of the clearest things that Trump has said, that J.D. Vance has said, and Project 2025 has said is fire the experts, fire the civil servants, fire the doctors, fire the environmentalists and those who track hurricanes and replace them with political hacks like RFK Jr. And I think that is one of the more likely things to happen. You don't even necessarily need House approval for some of these things. And so, yeah, they could dramatically remake the federal government. And it's not just in the Project 2025, which they run away from. J.D. Vance said this for years. So I think one of the things that and I don't think most Americans want this to happen. I think they heard Trump dismiss it and known I would never do this. But I think one of the most likely things to happen is that remaking. And if anyone doubts that Trump would do this, he actually did it with an executive order in 2020 that didn't have time to happen before he lost the election. But I think one of the clear commitments that every aspect of the sort of conservative world has talked about is replacing true experts with people like RFK. And that is something that I think is one of the highest risks. I don't think everything Trump has said I hope not everything Trump has said or everything that sort of some of his supporters want, you know, some want IVF bans, some want a national abortion ban. There'll be a lot of sorting out which of those things happen and which don't. But I do think the remaking of the federal government to represent something we haven't seen in our lifetimes, if ever, you know, a politicized DOJ, a politicized FBI, you know, a privatization of the National Weather Service, all those things, I think they are very serious about. And I think that's the kind of thing that we should really be on the lookout for as soon as they take power, because they're very serious about it. They've promised to do it. And they've kind of almost been unanimous in wanting to do that, as opposed to only certain elements wanting to do it.
I want to talk a little bit about the U.S. Senate race here in Ohio. Incredibly expensive, Morgan. $731 million spent for a single Senate race, probably record-breaking in history. Sherrod Brown ran about 6 points ahead of Donald Trump, but that was not enough to get him across the finish line. What should Democrats take away from Brown's performance last night?
Yeah, I mean, this was a really tough loss. Obviously, Sherrod Brown's had such a great track record in the U.S. Senate and really standing up for all Ohioans. And so I think I share the sentiments of a lot of folks who were really, really disappointed to see this result. I think one of the takeaways is just looking at the role of money in politics. I don't think that Bernie Moreno would have been a viable candidate against someone like Sherrod Brown without so much outside money coming in, you know, particularly from the crypto industry. But we also shouldn't overstate the role of money in politics as well. There was a lot of money available on our side for that campaign. And so I do think, you know, getting back to one of my earlier points, you know, we do have to have this reflection on what are the people of Ohio telling us as well? And look, I mean, it's a Trump election, so all of that with a grain of salt as well. Trump's relationship with the voters of Ohio is definitely sui generis. But, you know, I think there is this desire for political outsiders and a real skepticism of career politicians. And we can't just ignore that, even though, you know, we know there's some great career politicians like, you know, Sherrod Brown. that the people are skeptical. And I actually think it does in some ways connect to, you know, what David was saying, the risk of Project 2025 and what we might see in this Trump administration. You know, I think in some ways a lot of the reasons why people don't necessarily process that as a real threat is because they don't understand exactly what the government does and how it is actually helping their lives. And so, you know, I think on a couple of fronts, we have an educational messaging challenge in terms of, you know, making one to push back in a defense mode to prevent the Project 2025 agenda from being implemented. But then also at every level of government, from having our elected officials understand that that is a role in governing, is making sure the public understands what exactly you're doing and why it matters. And then and being real about, you know, the types of folks that we have to run that are going to be able to feed into that desire for change, for folks who aren't part of, you know, the political establishment, to make sure that we can put together the coalition that'll keep us viable at the statewide level.
I want to play a clip of Sherrod Brown from his concession speech after Bernie Moreno won last night.
We may be tempted to say hope was not enough. We might be tempted to second guess ourselves and question whether we worked hard enough or long enough. That is not our story tonight.
David, do you think that's fair? I mean, 10, 11 points spread to cover. I'm not sure any candidate, even Brown, could have met that moment.
Yeah, once you're at, I mean, I think people always thought 7 or 8 points, if it got a little closer than Biden, Trump, that Sherrod's overperformance would carry it. But I'm just looking at the numbers now. You start get to double digits, and it gets very difficult. You know, if you look at the actual numbers, I mean, what you need to happen to win Ohio is you need to have a surge in the suburbs, because the view would be that the Republicans are too extreme. You need really good urban turnout, and you need to hold your margins of loss down in the rural. And so far, I don't think any of those three things happened. I mean, if you had told me that Delaware County, which Democrats have thought recently, hey, Delaware is moving blue, you know, I voted for issue one last November. If you had told me, you know, 2 weeks ago that Delaware was going to vote +7 Trump, I would have said, well, we've got problems. Delaware, I'm looking at it now, also voted for Marino by 1.6. I think Democrats would have thought, hey, you know, you can win Delaware. Sherrod could win Delaware. Lorain County, it's kind of a bellwether, because if you win it by 15 or so, you're going to win Ohio as a Democrat. If you win it by 3 to 5, you're not.
No.
Sherrod won it by 5. I mean, so I do think that you know, he did overperform. But you need to run. One thing that's happened for years, I think the statement that Ohio is a pure bellwether has always been a little bit misleading. We lean a little bit to the right. You have to run a near-perfect race like Obama did to win. And that means, again, high urban numbers, shave the margins in rural, nice performance in suburbs. And that just didn't happen yesterday, which explains why, even though he overperformed, it wasn't enough, despite, you know, incredibly hard-fought campaign and someone who's very well-known. I agree with Morgan. I mean, you need to have, you know, the next generation of candidates in Ohio. There has to be a deeper level connection with everyday people.
We're popping up along a break. We will be back in just a moment when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
What happens in Washington? The NPR Politics Podcast is here for you. For the latest news, insights, and analysis from the election and beyond, listen to the NPR Politics Podcast.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. Republicans swept the statewide offices in Ohio last night and held on to their supermajorities in the statehouse. Their wins were reflective of a red wave throughout the Midwest that appears to have made Donald Trump the second president in history to serve two non-consecutive terms in office. Still with us is attorney and former Senate candidate Morgan Harper. Thanks for sticking with us. I want to talk about the U.S. House of Representatives. It is still up in the air who is going to control the chamber, but it looks like in Ohio, incumbency did matter. Democrats Greg Landsman, Amelia Sykes, and Marcy Kaptur appear to have kept their seats.
Yeah, this is interesting because, you know, there might be the instinct to think that the federal races are all going to play in the same way. However people are perceiving the president, it'll be tough for a congressional candidate to also overcome some of those headwinds. But here it does appear that the ability to connect with folks locally, Marcy Kaptur having her long reputation in the district, Amelia Sykes, they were able to hold on. So, I mean, I think that's a ray of hope for us as Ohio Democrats in a night that didn't offer many, perhaps. But that, you know, that combination of really having the connection to the district and having a strong message, you know, especially pointing to Marcy again, that has been inconsistent on that economic message for so long, does cut through and people are willing to support you.
And oh my goodness, in Kaptur's race, every vote matters. I think she's ahead by 1,500 votes at this point. Very, very close.
Yes. And it's so critical because, you know, regardless of what party you affiliate with, I do think that we should all be a little bit skeptical, especially with someone like Donald Trump coming into the presidency with so much uncertainty about how he does intend to govern, with having no split government at all, no check on that power. And so if we were to have, you know, the Republican Party control both chambers in Congress in addition to the executive branch and the state of the Supreme Court, that's a dangerous situation from my perspective.
Finally, before we switch over to your Republican counterparts to get their take on the election, I want to talk about issue one. The proposed constitutional amendment would have taken redistricting from Ohio's elected officials and put it in the hands of a 15-member citizen commission. The amendment failed by about 7 points here in Ohio, but the limited polling we had on issue one showed it passing by a significant margin. What the heck happened?
Yeah, this was a surprising result. It does seem, and I will admit, I think on a show affiliated with this station, I myself underestimated just, you know, how much the confusion around the ballot language probably impacted things. I talked to several people on Election Day and leading up to Election Day who said that they didn't quite understand what the language meant. And even though they intended to support the ballot initiative, they ended up voting no or just skipped it altogether. And so that was another, sad outcome from last night. And look, I mean, it's also just very inconsistent with what we were talking about earlier. And we're hearing from a lot of folks in Ohio that are skeptical of politicians, that don't want politicians controlling their lives, to think that folks wouldn't be willing to support this that would bring some more fairness to the map drawing process. The Trump year is not an easy one. I imagine that there's going to be some consideration of pursuing this again. And I certainly hope, and I know a lot of folks across the state would hope to be able to get this one right the next time.
That was attorney and former candidate for U.S. Senate, Morgan Harper. Thank you so much, as always.
Thanks for having me.
Now we're going to pivot to the Republicans here in Ohio and abroad, asking them for their take on the election. Jordan Aller is the vice president of Swing State Strategies, and he joins us now. Welcome to All Sides, Jordan.
Hey, Anna. Thanks for having me.
We also have former Republican state lawmaker Gene Krebs. Gene, welcome back to All Sides.
Good morning. Glad to be with you.
Hope you both got a little bit of sleep last night. I'm running on about three and a half hours.
About the same. About the same.
Jordan.
I'm on my third cup of coffee.
Jordan, it was a good night for Republicans here in Ohio and across the country. Donald Trump is on his way back to the White House. Bernie Moreno is headed to a Republican-controlled Senate. And our state added two more Republican justices to the Supreme Court. Jordan, I have to ask, did this, in the end, all come down to James Carville's famous line about elections? It's the economy, stupid.
Well, it was the economy and it was the border. At the end of the day, voters came out and talked. When we talk about the economy too, Anna, it's important to talk about not just top lines, but where it actually matters in the pocketbook on the table when you walk in your front door, how you feel at the end of the workday for the time you put in and your ability to live your life and provide for your family. That's what it came down to. This was an important election on that front. 4 years ago, people remembered a time when they could afford groceries, when prices were not double what they are now. In their waking adult memories, they knew a better time that saw more prosperity and more peace. I, for one, am very excited to get back to that those days. And for anybody out there who's mourning today, I will tell you this, the country's going to get better and your life will get better. And sit back, relax, it's going to be okay.
Gene, the price of groceries has certainly jumped over the last 4 years. And this administration is unpopular. The Biden administration has been underwater. But these are two things that we knew a year ago, before the very first primary votes were ever cast. I wonder if you, is it a fundamental mistake of Democrats to have not had a primary, to have pushed so hard for Biden to be the nominee until it was too late for anybody else to really enter the race?
That's a very valid statement. And but I do want to expand also on what Jordan just alluded to. I'll give you a case in point. When you asked me to appear on this program, my email back to you says, well, I'd love to, but the caveat that I'm only been getting 2 megabytes per second. And today I'm still getting about 2 megabytes per second. And so when Jordan talks about the economy and how people feel, it totally depends on where you sit. And Anna, much of your audience is college educated. And for that cohort, it's going okay. Okay. But if you're not college educated, things can be pretty grim. And for those of us out in rural Ohio, and I'm talking to you from 111 miles away, the rural white men were the first to die. You know, we die in the wars. We fight in the wars disproportionately, and we have a much shorter lifespan. So for my neighbors and relatives, which I use interchangeably around here, this was a matter for them of they do not feel like they have been included totally in this American dream, and they're pushing back on it. And you saw the same thing. This is why Trump was able to appeal to Hispanic men, Black men, is because when you look at the educational attainment of men across the board, all ethnic groups, we're falling behind. And the question is why. It's complex. It's subtle. There's going to be a lot of subtle solutions to it. But yeah.
That's well said. Could I just add to that as well?
Oh, yeah, of course.
I feel like it's interesting that Democrats are waking up to a country where Donald Trump might be the next president, but the party, the Democrat Party, has a greater problem in that the Republican Party is now the party for African-Americans and Latinos and Mexicans and hardworking people, working class people. These are fundamental bedrock voters for Democrats that are waving goodbye to the party and coming over to the Republican Party for the first time in their lives. It's as shocking to us as anybody, but it's proof positive that, you know, the economy is hurting people and people are rejecting the Biden-Harris administration and blaming them for it.
Yeah, Trump picked up Latino voters in particular by double digits, something that would have seemed impossible for a Republican a decade ago. Back in 2012, you know, there was a whole conversation about whether Republicans needed to fundamentally rethink their policies, particularly when it came to Hispanic voters. It's fascinating to me, Gene, to see this realignment within 12 years.
Oh, okay. So as you've heard me say ad nauseum when we appear together on Columbus on the Record with Mike Thompson, check your local listings for times. Last week, we buried former Speaker Joanne Davidson. And Jordan, your former boss, Betty Montgomery, did a wonderful eulogy for Joanne. But Joanne was, it's ironic that we buried her, and then yesterday we buried the Chamber of Commerce Republican. If you listen to J.D. Vance's speech at the convention, it was very much putting the blame on corporations. The larger the corporation, the more the blame. And if you really want to understand how J.D. Vance views the world, I'm going to advise all your listeners to read Orrin Cass, O-R-E-N-C-A-S-S. And what's interesting is that WOSU had a few years back, J.D. Vance interviewed Orrin Cass for one of your programs for an hour long. And it's very remarkable. It's not the Republicans of the Reagan era. J.D. Vance directly called for tax increases. And Orrin Cass is going, yeah, we're going to have to. This is a populism that resonates very, 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 very well with the non-college educated.
Yeah, for the first
time. Or as I say, where I'm from, where my neighbors and relatives, which is a phrase I use interchangeably.
Yeah. Harris picked up about 3% of white college-educated voters in this election. But as we've said this morning, they do not represent a majority of the country. I do wonder what comes next in terms of the congressional races. So in the Senate, it looks like the U.S. Senate will go to the Republicans. The House is still up in the air. But here in Ohio, Jordan, it looks like the three Democratic incumbents will hang on to their seats. Marcy Kaptur's race is incredibly close, but it looks like she may have defied the odds and stuck it out.
Yeah, that's an incredibly close race, and I'm sorry, and I don't have those numbers quite, you know.
Like it's about 1,200 or 1,500 like votes apart. Very close.
That fascinating. Well, Derek Maron ran a really great race against Marcy Kaptur, who, you know, has been has led that area for a long, long time, and he was stacked campaign against him on that front. But it sounds like it came very close. I'm not surprised that the turnout in Ohio, you know, like I said, it came down to the economy, and voters were, you know, blaming Democrats across the board for feelings of insecurity, for feelings of, you know, I cannot afford my own lifestyle anymore. And my lifestyle did not change. The economy changed around me, and I can no longer afford it. You know, there's real pain out there that I think Democrats just refuse to acknowledge. They refuse to allow people to see what they see. They refuse to allow people to see that President Joe Biden a long time ago was probably not ready to be president anymore. And that switch should have been made a while ago. But for a long time, the media and the Democrats told the American people, don't believe your own eyes. And then when the American people complained about
it. Yeah,
go ahead, Gene.
I was just going to say, I do want to agree with what Jordan just said and expand on it, that a fully functioning Democrat National Committee would have recognized the faults of Joe Biden exactly a year ago. And they would have had an intervention and gone, look, you're just simply, you know, you're just not going to be up to this. And they did not.
Yeah, I will also say in the Kaptur race, I just pulled up the numbers. Marcy Kaptur is still edging out a victory, but the Libertarian candidate, Tom Pruss, has 4% of the vote. He may end up playing spoiler in that congressional race. But, Jean, I do want to get your take on something, because when we look at the U.S. Senate races, Arizona, Michigan, Wisconsin, still too close to call, but it looks like the Democratic Senate candidates may win those seats. Brown definitely outperformed Harris here in Ohio. I wonder if that feeds into this narrative, perhaps, that voters were rejecting the administration. They were rejecting Biden-Harris, and they may not have rejected a different candidate. We can't run that. We can't Monday morning quarterback it. But the Democrats running for statewide offices are outperforming the Biden-Harris ticket.
That's data I have not yet seen. I appreciate it. In thinking about that, I think that and I said this also on the Mike Thompson show with you, that the Democrats, if they were smart, they would not go with either Harris or Newsom, the governor of California. They would have gone with a fresh face, not from California, from someone from the Midwest. I thought that Gretchen from
Whitmer
from Michigan would have been a much stronger candidate on their part. But they didn't ask me for my advice, and I couldn't give it to them. So there we go.
Yeah, we're going to take a quick break. But coming up, we're going to talk about 2026 and who might run for J.D. Vance's Senate seat. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
No matter what happens in Washington, the NPR Politics Podcast is here for you. For the latest news, insights, and analysis from the election and beyond, listen to the NPR Politics Podcast.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. J.D. Vance will be leaving Ohio for Washington, D.C. He will be our country's next vice president, which means he's going to be vacating his U.S. Senate seat come January. Still with us to talk about it is Jordan Oler, vice president of Swing State Strategies, and Gene Krebs, a former Republican state lawmaker. Look, I know I'm a terrible person for talking about 2026, the day after the 2024 election, but Governor Mike DeWine will need to appoint someone to replace Vance in just a couple of weeks. Jordan, any thoughts on who it's going to be?
Well, Anna, the political cycle does move that fast, so you're not out of line to be asking the question. I'd love to hear what my counterpart thinks as well, but you got to think about what Mike DeWine is thinking about. You know, he's been, you know, serving the state for a long time and with high integrity. So he's thinking about legacy right now. And what is that pick for him that's going to signal, you know, who Mike DeWine was to Ohio and what he says about the future? I'm very interested in that. I think, you know, I don't have any picks. We were talking about this last night. You know, all of us have different ideas. But, you know, I think it would be interesting if Mike DeWine looked at a woman for a U.S. senator for the first time ever. So I think Jane Timken could be high on a list if he's considering from a demographic standpoint. Certainly she's very close to Donald Trump, true supporter, be a great pick for him. But certainly there's other ones out there that are looking. I know Kevin Coughlin, he endorsed him in the election. And I'm sorry, I misspoke on that. Coughlin.
Yeah.
So that'll be interesting to see how he looks at his own legacy as he makes this pick. And certainly that person will signal what he thinks about it.
Yeah. Gene, the governor endorsed State Senator Matt Dolan in the primary over Bernie Moreno. Secretary of State Frank LaRose also ran in that primary. There's a lot of names floating around out there right now. But I do think, Gene. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say that I don't want to induce nausea in your listeners, but we're only 16 months away from filing deadline.
Yeah.
And whoever it is going to be known in about a year. It doesn't really matter what Mike DeWine wants. Yes, he'll make the appointment. But if Trump and or J.D. Vance weigh in with their personal pick, DeWine would find it very hard to go against them because they will back that person in a primary and they will beat whoever he appoints. And I'm not a betting person because I believe gambling leads to dancing, which is the highest sin. But I think that they'll go with Vivek Ramaswamy. And I have academic background on this, of course. And that is, if you look up the Curley Effect by Dr. Ed Glaser out of Harvard, politicians choose constituencies and people and their members to look just like them. And so Vivek Ramaswamy is a true populist. J.D. Vance is a true populist. And I think that's probably who they're going to go with. I don't think it matters what any of the rest of us think.
Yeah, I assume the governor will make a decision potentially by the end of this year, only because this person has to go be sworn in January. So definitely stay tuned. You know, I have a question for you guys, because the polls predicted a close race, and the race was close in the swing states. I think of it as clear, but close is my takeaway. I wonder if either of you have any more confidence in polling, given how this election turned out.
Well, Anna, that's a great point. I woke up this morning, I was talking to my wife, and I was saying how shocked I was that the polling held up. The electoral process did what it should have done. We saw very few problems with voting lines, things like that, very few lawsuits that were consequential in the election. And we had a fairly early night. So I was glad to see the process work out, you know, peacefully, you know, all of us to see, you know, have clarity in the morning to start dealing with it, you know, one way or the other, to wake up and start moving forward together as a country. It's a great thing to see.
Yeah, I will say Vice President Kamala Harris is expected to address the nation at 4 p.m. WOSU will be covering it live when it happens. But, Gene, it seems like the pollsters have finally figured out a methodology for capturing Trump voters.
Some of them have, not all of them. It was pretty much a mixed bag. But I do think, and so I'm, when I say this, I'm going to sound like Steve Bannon, but I've been following the writings of Strauss and Howe in the fourth turning longer than what Steve Bannon has. And what I you saw there was a massive turn, a shift, a new political structure emerge yesterday, last night. And that will be the dominant populism will be the dominant political philosophy by the Republican Party moving forward for the next 80 years.
Yeah, I definitely.
And it, I was just going to say, I've talked to many political operatives of, you know, who know a lot more about this than I do. People like Jordan, and they all express amazement to me that they all began, you know, running Republican campaigns as the business, you know, the business party, and now they're having to think about having to run campaigns as the populist party, and that's quite the shift for them.
Yeah. You know, yesterday we did a whole episode on the history of the American ballot. And one of the things we talked about that was particularly interesting is, you know, you look back at the Reconstruction, post-Reconstruction South, all of the minority voters, all the black voters were Republicans because that was the party of Lincoln. And then, you know, in the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, they started to make the move towards the Democrats. Maybe they're realigning with Republicans. It is so fascinating to me, Jordan, the way who makes up each political party ebbs and flows and shifts like over the decades.
Yeah, I agree. Democrats have now found themselves the party of big government and standing on the side of big corporations. And, you know, your listeners may reject that, but that's the way the American people are viewing them now. They're viewing big things as scary and dangerous to their interests. They've seen the systems fail them. They've seen the systems lie to them, and they're waking up to it now. So there's definitely been a realignment on that. Many Americans are waking up and just starting to believe their own eyes about what they're seeing in the world and taking charge of it, knowing that it does not have to be this way. It wasn't this way 4 years ago. And, you know, these economic issues, these safety issues, they transcend partisan politics. They transcend skin color. They transcend all the things we thought we knew about demographics and race and gender in this country. Let's not forget that a lot of women did vote for Donald Trump. They voted because they were worried about their own pocketbook and their own budget and their own house. You know, women still make a lot of budgetary decisions, whether or not there's a man in the house. They were voting with their pocketbook as well. Let's not forget that.
Yeah, I do want to talk about female voters. Abortion was on the ballot in a number of states. Looks like it's passing in Montana, in Missouri. Florida's a unique case. 57% of Floridians voted for greater abortion access. Their threshold is 60%, though. So it did fail despite having a majority of voters. Jean, it seems access to reproductive rights is important to women, important to all voters, but doesn't translate in to support for the party who allegedly protects them.
So I have to go back into the ancient history of 1995. After we took majority in the House, our pollster came in and said to us, okay, you own the college educated. You own them because of taxes and government regulation. But here's the cautionary note. They're squishy, he said, on the issue of abortion. They are personally pro-life, but they think that they've always had a college roommate, a sister, an aunt who's had faced a difficult situation, and they'd like to keep that option open. That's now emblematic, shall we say, of the shift we're seeing that Jordan wisely alluded to. And it's still a lot to get your head wrapped around.
Yeah. I mean, the idea that people are single issue voters, I always worry that that's like an oversimplification of things, that people have a lot of different aspects that they're weighing when they're deciding on a candidate.
I will also say that I think that the dominant party will also be the one who's the most empathic in their populism. And at the same time, also, like Jordan was talking about, sort of a libertarian populism as specified by Orrin Cass. This is going to be a tightrope for a while till they figure out where they're all going to be.
I wonder whether either of you think Harris being a woman played a role in her loss. We're probably going to be hearing some think pieces. Her electoral map looks a lot like Hillary Clinton's map in 2016.
No, I don't think it particularly had anything to do with, gender as far as a misogynistic approach would be considered. I mean, there's a lot of Democrats waking up this morning and deciding that, Kamala Harris lost because of misogyny or this idea that a woman shouldn't be president. That's why America voted for Donald Trump. It's just not true. I think the American people saw what they saw. They saw a candidate who wasn't quite ready to be president. They saw her standing behind a candidate who clearly was not competent to be president. They knew they were being lied to. So at the end of the day, this had nothing, I think, to do with her gender or any kind of, downward look at her for her career path. Certainly, she's been a prosecutor, high points in her career, but there was something missing. There was something missing in her ability to connect with people. And certainly, she never acknowledged the pain that was out there because she was standing next to Joe Biden most of the time, having to defend Bidenomics. That really put her in a corner with her ability to message this campaign.
I want to talk a little bit about issue one here in Ohio. Redistricting was on the ballot for the fifth time in 20 years, and it failed to pass yet again. Dean, what happened here? I talked to Senate President Matt Huffman last night. He said, I think redistricting passes in the state of Ohio when Republicans and Democrats can agree on what the changes should be. Is that a fair takeaway?
No. Hold my coffee and watch me pick a fight with the president of the state Senate. It failed for two reasons. One, the ballot language was obtuse, to put it politely, and difficult for people to immediately intuitively understand what it was about. But the second thing was, about a month ago, my publisher had their national conference in Toledo. And for those of you who don't know me, I drive a convertible. It was a
Oh.
beautiful fall day. And the top was down, and I took all the back roads home to Morning Sun, Ohio from Toledo. I saw maybe 1,000 vote no signs on issue one. I saw three vote yes signs on issue one. Vote yard signs don't vote, but they give permission for people to vote. And so when I got home, I looked up the if you want to get a sign for vote yes on issue one, between Toledo and my farm near Oxford, Ohio, you had exactly Lima. That was the only place you could pick up a sign. So in other words, the vote yes campaign had no ground game. By comparison, the vote no on issue one had a maybe 80 to 100 state reps and state senators out there. And every time they're giving a speech for the Kiwanis, Rotary Lions, whatever, they're saying vote no on issue one. So they ha so no had a ground game. Yes, did not have a ground game. And you and it, as Jordan will attest to, you can spend a lot of money, but you do need a ground game at a certain point in time.
Jordan.
Certainly ground game where there is so much confusion about the topic.
Yeah.
There's the, going back a long time, Ohioans, if they're confused about the constitutional amendment in front of them, they will say no. If there's any level of confusion, they'll say no to it. Because, if you had to ask people yesterday, would you support or not support gerrymandering, that would have been a different election. But the other side, the yes side, had the burden of instituting this bureaucracy, which Ohioans were so confused by. They said, we don't like maybe the political process or how this works, maybe too much politics, but they were injecting just so much more politics and bureaucracy into it, unaccountable, unelected officials. And people were confused by that. I saw them at the polling place, lots of folks standing by looking at this giant, it was a mural that it took to explain the text that was on the wall. And it was, I think, in 14 point type at best. I mean, it was not huge type. So, they spent a lot of time looking at it, and they still could not understand a word. And we saw the result pretty much trend to the same as Donald Trump's vote tally is. Vote no, and Donald Trump got about the same amount of support.
Yeah, I think.
Except
Oh,
I
go
will
ahead.
say that the identical language in Michigan got 57%, but I think that goes to the ballot language in Michigan accurately reflected what was on the ballot. And my understanding, which is thin, is that Michigan proponents actually had a ground game.
Well, we'll have to wait and see whether they bring it back in 2026, but we are going to leave it there. I want to say thank you to Jordan Oler, Vice President of Swing State Strategies. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you, Anna. Thanks for having me. Good to see you, Jean.
and former Republican state lawmaker Gene Krebs. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much. Good to see you, Jordan. And Anna, I'll see you on the next Columbus On the Record with Mike Thompson. Check your local listings.
And be sure to check All Sides out on Facebook and follow us on Twitter and Instagram, WOSU All Sides. Thanks for listening on 89.7 NPR News.